Office buildings trading at 20 to 25 cents in a dollar replacement cost. More square footage being demolished or converted than built for the first time in decades. And yet the headlines still say that office is dead. And if that's true, somebody's about to make a lot of money off being wrong. I'm Kevin Bupp, and this is the Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast. This show is all about uncovering real-world cash flow strategies, and today's office conversation is a reminder that typically the best opportunities often live where the headlines preach doom and gloom. In this show, we're going to be unpacking why office might be the buy of the decade despite ugly headlines. We're going to talk about how to use replacement cost, supply destruction, and submarket data to separate great opportunities from future write-offs, and then what underwriting guardrails and debt terms actually make sense for office in this real estate cycle. Now, to walk us through it, I'm joined here today by Michael Bull, a 35-year commercial real estate veteran. Michael has spent more than 35 years in commercial real estate. He's completed more than $8 billion of transactions. He leads Bull Realty's national office group. And since 2010, he's been the host of America's Commercial Real Estate Show. And so today, it's going to be an exciting one. We're going to dive into a topic that Michael has been shouting from the mountaintop about as of lately, and that is why office may be the buy of the decade. So, Michael, welcome to the show, my friend. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Well, thank you, Kevin. If you're starting out with the how I love office, most of your listeners are going to say, "What office? This guy's crazy."
Well, you know, it is. It's funny, but everyone is aware of the adage of going against the herd or buying when there's blood in the streets, right? But when the blood's actually flowing, everyone doesn't know what the hell to do, right? Everyone's like, everyone gets scared and has trepidation. So I'm excited to unpack this with you here today. You know, it's interesting. I was just talking a little bit before we got rolling here that, you know, while we're predominantly parking and manufactured housing investors, I mean, that's our MO. We bought an office building. It was kind of take all or take nothing back in Phoenix about 2.5 years ago. And it's been an amazing investment. You know, bought it probably at what we could have called the bottom of the Phoenix marketplace and bought it for well below replacement cost at an incredibly low basis. And it has, you know, worked wonders for us in our portfolio. So, we're not office guys, but we happen to own some office. And so again, excited to have this conversation here today. So I've read a number of articles where you have said that, you know, office might be the buy of the decade. Are there any specific data points that you can speak to, Michael, that support that belief?
Yeah. First of all, you know, I'm an old guy, right? So I've been around a while and I've been through several downturns and recessions and recoveries. And, you know, if you look historically, the first one when I was a kid, was the S&L crisis in 86, 87. And apartment values they changed the depreciation, laws. And all the apartments just tanked in value. There was tons of foreclosures. Savings and loans, lenders had the most of the loans. They started failing. It was a crazy change in the government, but apartments just went down the tube and no one wanted them. The groups that bought apartments after that became extremely wealthy, right? It's just they bought when it was down. If you look at the last recession we had, you know, people were saying houses were no good. No one's going to want houses anymore. You know, they had one group called the Ring of Death around Atlanta that no one's ever even going to build outside of this. Well, what happened? Home values escalated. You know, people who bought homes, you know, have done extremely well. You look back, we've had times when the retail was left for dead. No one's going to shop anymore. Everybody's online, right? What happened? You know, retail for the most part doing extremely well. Well, here we are with office, and not only have we had, you know, a sudden increase in interest rates that has never happened in history, but we had the work from home from the COVID and all that. So you had a little bit of overbuilding and older properties, but you had a severe change and that really hurt the market. So I believe office is the buy of the decade. You know, if you look at some of the trades out there that you're aware of and you've experienced yourself, you know, there's buildings like we just sold a 17 story tower, at $60 a foot. And it would cost, without the tenant improvements, it would cost $600 a foot to build it. Maybe more, add the tenant improvements. You got another, you know, $100 or $150 depending on the build out. So, you've got some incredible buys. We just, another example, we just did a a stable 9% cap rate office sale here in Atlanta. That one was in the Southeast, but the one in Atlanta, and it was 95% occupied, 9 cap, sold at 100 a foot. And to your point earlier about buying below replacement cost, I mean, you can't build that building for, you know, what is that, 20 cents, 25 cents on the dollar. Now, also, you look at the report, Kevin, that came out a few months back that suggested that in the U.S., there's more office space being torn down, demolished, or converted to other uses than there is being delivered new to the market. That hasn't happened in 35 years. So if you're looking at markets where there's job growth and there's population growth and there's no new supply, you know, supply and demand affects the value of everything. So I think it's going to be just like history has shown us in these other property types. When no one wants them, to your point earlier, it might be time to look at them.
Yeah, no, that's great. A lot to unpack there. So let's start with the replacement cost piece of it and using that as a metric for valuations. You know, you gave that first example there. I think it was 25 cents on a dollar of what it would cost to build today. I think it was a 17 story office tower that recently traded. What, you know, most would say that there's no way to lose, but that's not necessarily the case, right? Not all office properties are created equal, and just because you could buy it below replacement cost doesn't mean that you're actually going to, you know, get an ROI. You might actually still lose money at that point. So is the initial metric that you might be looking at as far as an opportunity, and this is assuming that you're in a good marketplace, like you're in a good submarket. First valuation would be, hey, what can we buy this at to its actual replacement cost today? But then what are other considerations that come into play to really make a determination to check the boxes that we feel very strongly about this investment and feel as though we can get a good, you know, IRR or, you know, equity multiple, whatever the metric is that you're chasing after.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you could get what seems like a really cheap price and still not make money or lose money, right? Well, I think it's different on every asset and every property. And I think that's more so now than it ever has been. Two buildings identical to each other across the street can have way different values. But I think it depends on the underwriting. Like, to give you a couple examples, in office properties, it's good to look at, are the tenants actually using the space? Where the lease is done, new or renewed after COVID, you know, what are the main condition of the components? And then look down at the, market itself. Is it growing? What's absorption look like? How's it being leased? You know, what needs to be done differently and having a plan to turn it around, in a timeline. And I think what's good about the timing right now is that, with no new supply, if you are in a growing market, then you have demand start creeping up. What do you need to do to the property to get it where tenants really want to be there? And I think that's one of the big things that's happened with this change is, you know, tenants, employees, employers, people in our industry realize that the office needs to be a place people want to be now, you know, not a place they have to be.
Actually, let me back up a little bit because I'd love to get your perspective here. I think a lot of maybe folks that aren't in the office space that don't have a deep knowledge of it, a lot think that the challenges it's facing today or has faced for the last couple of years are all driven by COVID. And while some of that's true, but that's not entirely true. Were there, you know, some weak points of the chain or links in the chain prior to COVID? And if so, what were they?
Yeah, there has been. I mean, there was a bit of overbuilding. And yeah, you know, some of the markets just have had, you know, high vacancy. Some of the stock is older. And if you look at, you know, the headlines, especially if you're in another sector and you look, or not in an industry, and you look at the headlines about vacancy factors and what they are, and they look high. Well, you got to keep in mind that there's different classes of office. There's different submarkets in a city. And there's also some buildings in that vacancy that aren't really available, that there's no tenant improvement allowances. There's no leasing commission. So no one's leasing in those buildings. So while it adds to the vacancy level, it's not really available, you know? I think there's a lot of reasons that you want to look at each property individually and make a plan for it and understand it, and not, you know, just look at it, obviously, because it's cheap.
And to your point there, why something might not be leasing up, you know, if they're not providing any TI or build out cost, basically, more than likely, the reason is that the ownership group probably doesn't have the capital necessary to breathe new life into the asset. Is that an accurate statement?
Yeah, that very much so. And we see that a lot. We see that some also in the medical office. We have a medical office division and a government leased office division. And on the medical office side, sometimes we see private owners like doctors, and they'll have spaces vacant for years and years because they're not offering proper commissions and TI. And, you know, they just don't understand the industry. And, you know, their competitors are institutional owners or savvy owners who know, hey, you take care of the tenant rep, baby, and you have a generous TI allowance and underwrite it that way. But, yeah, it's an interesting market. And one of the things that, I think you and your listeners might like is sometimes we get called in when something is not selling or leasing. And they say, Michael, you know, what's wrong here? What's wrong? And we've just done it this week on several properties. And we look at, first of all, the marketing. How well is the marketing being done? And then we'll look at the product and the deliverables, right? How does it show? What are the deliverables on the underlying income and expense and the deliverables, right, on the property? And then the price, right? If it's overpriced, the best broker and the best marketing is not going to help, right? So we look at all three of those things. And I think when you're looking at an investment property, you want to look at that kind of on the leasing side as well. You know, are they offering TI? If tenant is looking for space, will they find it in any system they go to? If they call on it, are they getting immediate response? And I love my commercial broker friends, but one of the challenges we have in our industry is some of us don't respond very quickly or efficiently. It's really bad on landlord project leasing from the landlords themselves sometimes and for the brokers. And, you know, when we're doing tenant rep assignments, we start seeing that the landlord reps and landlords that are slow to react just don't get as many of the tenants. So if you do things right and you can look at what somebody's doing and see, are they doing it right? And can you do it better?
Got to answer your phone and return the calls, right?
You got to show up. Isn't that crazy?
It sounds so simple. It sounds so simple. Yeah. You know, there was a big flight to quality during the COVID years. You know, a lot of, you know, tenants that still wanted to be, you know, in the office, they kind of had a pick of the litter, right? Like there mm-hmm. was some opportunity for them to kind of move up. And so curious to your perspective on maybe some of the older vintage buildings, you know, B-class or C-class, or even some of the stuff that just maybe would deem to be, you know, functionally obsolescent, you know, the layout or, you know, I guess where does that go? Like what is the opportunity there? Is it just a buy it at such a low basis, we tear it down and just look at the land value and look to do something else with it? Or is there truly new life that can be breathed into some of these older vintage buildings? So again, to your point, employers really need to put the emphasis on making the office be a place that their employees want to come work, right? And actually enjoy being there, not just, you know, have to suffer through 8 hours. And then, you know, all they're thinking about is getting the hell out of there, right? And getting back home or getting outside. I know a lot of landlords have really made it be a more of a destination. They've got, you know, restaurants, they've got gyms, they've got spas. I mean, they've got all kinds of services to really, you know, create an experience for the tenant base that's there. But what do we do with this old stock?
Well, it comes down to highest and best use analysis, right? And we end up doing that a lot, whether we're repping a buyer or a seller and looking at what should be done. Should it be torn down? Is there better value? Is it beyond its useful life period? There's a reason that's in appraisals because it happens. And you tear it down and build something new. Just to give an example, headquarter here in Atlanta, there's been some big office buildings where they've bought and torn them down, and built apartments and mixed use. We've seen some where they've torn down some of them, build mixed use around them and leave one of the buildings. We see some buildings that are changed into multi-use, some turned into, a multi-residential, and then some that you can bring back. So, I'm showing a very large building right now in Atlanta, office building. And I've got a buyer who says, look, I want to empty it and convert it. I think that's the best use. And another buyer says, no, I want to rent it up and energize it, to your point, Gavin, you know, put in some more amenities, make the building attractive, and fill it back up and take advantage of the lack of new supply. And then that demand trickles down, right, Kevin? The tenants who start filling up the A brand new stuff, they can't find enough. And then that trickles down, or those rents are just so high because there's a lack of product that, you know, it pushes companies down into the A minus, start getting into the B. So, we're starting to see that demand trickle down, if you will, into some of the lower priced assets. And then a lot of owners that are just savvy in making their buildings more attractive. We're seeing some converted to medical, where you have that demand and they're doing the things to convert. Again, you got to make sure the building's capable of that. Do you have gurney size elevators? Do you have the power? Do you have the backup power and those sorts of things? But, it's really a highest and best use down to each individual building we're finding.
What's the buyer pool look like? If you had to compare, the buyer pool, 2 years ago, to what it looks like today, are there a lot more active buyers in the office space? And do you see that increasing here over the coming years?
Yeah, it's much larger. And there's even lenders interested. It's like in doing loans potentially,
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. Cause I just assume that it's very challenging to find debt of any sorts that's attractive for an office, for more of an opportunistic buy. So what's out there in the marketplace?
It is, and that's part of what makes it a good buy. But part of why you have less competition, it knocks out the junior woodchucks. You need to have someone with some experience that have some access to capital and can run a plan, right, that the lender understands. But you might be relegated to a 50% loan to value, or you might have a requirement of a 1.5 debt coverage ratio. You're talking about some pretty heavy equity deals, which is why you get a lower basis, right? There's less buyers and less competition. So, it's part of what makes the timing right. If we could go get, 5%, 75% financing from every lender in town, the prices would be higher.
Yeah. No, again, it's funny. We all theoretically know that, this is where the opportunity lies, right? But, far too few people are actually willing or have the confidence to take advantage and dive in when there's still a little bit of uncertainty on the plate. And so it makes me actually think back. We started buying mobile home parks back in 2011, and I recall many occasions, not being able to get financing. There wasn't a lot of debt options for the product back then. Today, it's a night and day difference. I mean, you got lenders pounding down our door to make loans, on the properties. But a lot of folks, either they were scared of the asset class or they just didn't do it because there weren't good debt options available. But therein lied the opportunity, one of the big opportunities in that sector. And some of the highest returns that we've ever had were a result of the stuff that we bought, 10, 12 years ago when others were kind of running away from that product type. So not exact apples comparison of office, but again, just it was really challenging. There was easier ways to make money, traditional multifamily than that of going into this little subset of manufactured housing. But again, today it looks very different.
Well, the timing and the lack of financing availability is very similar. It's like I tell non-real estate people when they ask me about the time to buy, time to sell. I say, if you're at a cocktail party and everybody's talking about how great the market is and they're flipping contracts and all this stuff, it's time to sell. And if you're at the cocktail party and people are whining about foreclosures, a terrible market and all that, it's time to buy.
Get out and buy. Yep. No, I had one of those instances back in 2007 era, and I remember us at a restaurant and like a diner type place, and our waitress literally had just bought two properties, no documentation loans, and was bragging about these rental properties that she had, and I'm like, oh gosh, that's interesting. Something's about to occur here. I wish I would have sold everything right then and there, though I did not, unfortunately. The signs were there. Want to talk about the markets themselves. Obviously opportunities everywhere if you're willing to dig hard enough and look deep enough. But there are a few markets that, you know, might not have reached the bottom, or might just have, you know, quite a bit of still excess supply that, you know, proved them to be maybe a little more challenging than others. The two that come to mind, again, I'm not an office guy. I don't even have any data points to support this. This is just other chatter I've heard, you know, and maybe, you know, bits and pieces of articles I've read over the months and last couple of years. But Austin and Denver are the two that kind of come top of mind that have quite a bit of, you know, significantly higher vacancy in the office space than maybe a number of other markets. But are there any, I guess, where I'm going with this, are there any markets that you would still steer clear of today in the office sector?
Well, first, let me preface that with saying that there's opportunities in every market, you know, down to the submarket and the actual assets, right? Because if a market is really bad shape, it could be your best time to be buying when the outlook is completely terrible. But having said that, you know, San Francisco has some markets that have some vacancy issues, and recovery issues. DC with the Doge and all that going on is having some issues in some of the markets. Some of the markets doing well. Obviously, New York, you know, was doing terrible, and then it's one of the first to recover. They have more people working from their offices than they ever had before. As far as, you know, I guess they're not doing the 4-day work week, like seems like a lot of the rest of the country's doing, you know, Dallas, Boston, Chicago doing well. But again, I'd look down to, even if you're a local, you know, regional or you know, investing in your city, I think you want to look at opportunities and look at them close, because there can be opportunities in even in these worst markets, maybe even more so.
Are there any general, you know, underwriting guardrails that you put in place today, you know, when evaluating something, you know, vacancy assumptions, maybe TI expectations, free rent or concessions, I know every deal is specific and it's case by case scenario, but just generally speaking, is there anything you can share with us there of how you're looking at deals today?
Yeah, well, all those items you would look into and maybe get a really good project leasing broker or a couple to give you their thoughts on what incentives should be, TI packages should be, what should potentially be done to the property to make it more attractive. But on the basic underwriting, one of the things we look at is CapEx, what's been done, what might need to be done in the next 5 years or so, what should be done to the property to make it attractive to tenants and create more demand, what needs to be budgeted for TI and LC, tenant improvements and leasing commissions, how much are the tenants actually using that space, how much of it's on the sublease market, if any. Are the leases post-COVID as far as originated or renewed? And then just what's going on in that job market, right? And the demographics and the access that could create more or less demand for the property are a few things that we look at.
How important are tenant interviews during the buying process?
A lot of our buyers that we deal with love the buyer and the tenant interviews. Some of them are real, that's a real requirement for them. And then we have others that'll kind of look through their use of the space, look at their rent compared to market, which is another underwriting. Aren't as concerned about it because, you know, some of the tenants are going to tell you that everything's terrible, that you need to lower the rent. So sometimes you got to take it with a grain of salt, but, you know, we see it as we think it's really important on single tenant deals or on your big major tenants, right? To understand, you know, what are they like? What are they not like? What are their thoughts? What are their plans, if any, if they'll tell you? So, they can be important and more so in certain cases.
Is there, you gave some examples in the beginning of maybe some, what you felt were great buys or you know, things that have transacted here as of recently, but is there anything that comes to mind, maybe a case study you can share of a deal, I guess, from the outside looking in, look like could be a great opportunity, well, you know, price well below replacement cost, but something that you felt as though just wasn't a great buy, and if so, for what reasons?
One of the things I've seen is a really good opportunity is for parcel users. We've taken out a good bit of office buildings for sale in the Southeast U.S., some stable, some extremely distressed, and some, you know, half occupied. 7 out of the 8 we've taken out in the last 90 days were won by partial owner occupants who are filling some of the vacancy with their businesses. And so, you know, a couple things are happening there. One, they're getting in at incredibly low bases. It's extremely smart for users to be considering buying right now. It's just amazing time for them. Also, they're getting really good financing, right? You know, we talked about financing might be 50% down, 1.35 debt coverage ratio for an investor. A user has a good business that's successful. The lenders just fall over you and just, what do you want? What do you need? We've got you covered, right? So you get more leverage, you get a better rate, you get better terms, you get more offers for financing. So that's one of the biggest things I'm seeing out there. And there's been more and more users buying. And it depends on not just large or small, just all size users. Now, we do find the smaller the buildings, the less price reductions there are. So some of the smaller buildings, just very expensive still doing well. The larger the building, we tend to see in general a lower price per square foot and more distress. So we're finding the larger buildings are great deals. If you have the fortitude, emotionally and monetarily, to wait it out, invest in those deals, I think they're incredible. Yeah, we've sold some buildings at $60 a foot and $50 a foot that, we're in markets where they're showing improvement. And I think when we turn around 3, 4, or 5 years from now, those values will have doubled at a minimum. So it's a good time to buy in the sector.
From a buyer's perspective, having the investor hat on, how relevant is floor plate sizing when looking at an opportunity? Assuming that whether it's a small floor plate or a very large floor plate, you can get it at an incredible basis, below replacement cost. But what are some other considerations that you need to take into account when looking at, again, it sounds like larger floor plates create maybe more opportunity, but also higher risk, right? Because it becomes a much narrower subset of tenant that can maybe occupy an incredibly large space. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, it is. I mean, in generally speaking, and it's amazing. We talk to investors who really love single tenant buildings with one big tenant. Then we have some that would be scared to death of that one tenant going toes up, and that they like the smaller spaces, the smaller suites. So if a tenant leaves, it's not as big a hole in the income. Also with the really small suites, sometimes we see that there's not as many tenant reps involved because they can't afford to help these small tenants. So you don't have tenant leasing commissions. You also, if the really small suites, sometimes you don't really have custom build outs. So you don't have the TI. So in some of these little bitty suites, I've seen cost to operate be lower than apartments. There's no bathrooms, not for every suite and kitchens. And you don't have families and to turn them it's a coat of paint and some floor covering if you have to do it. So a lot of investors really like the smaller suites. But then some, like we've got a deal in Kentucky right now. They're all household name tenants. They have fairly large suites, but they're all extremely high credit in a beautiful building. And it's an 8-cap. And there's some people in groups that they really want those household names, that very high credit. Not only does it help them with their financing and their investors, but, they're dealing with very high profile people and companies, right? So it's really an eye of the beholder, but yes, generally speaking, I like for my investors, the smaller suites because of the lower risk tenant leaves. I was talking with office investor yesterday. He's owned about 18 buildings and he said, yeah, I really like the small suites because if they leave, I feel comfortable. I can release it back and I'm not losing sleep.
No, it's a great point. It's a great point. So I guess, as we round this out here, Michael, I mean, for someone that wants to maybe get into their first office deal, here in the new year, where should they begin? I mean, what's the next logical step, assuming they've got, some investing experience, they've owned other asset types, but really, see an opportunity in the office sector. What's the first step they need to take?
I would see if there's a user opportunity there, obviously, if you have a business or you have an investor or team, you know, partner that has a business. That's one opportunity. And I think the next opportunity is just to go out there and learn a market and understand who the brokers are, understand what the market is. You know, there's various markets within these geographic areas, right? One of the specialties we have is it's government lease buildings. It's an interesting market. They're mostly full service. And they are, they'll have cancellation rights for appropriations clauses. They'll have soft term and hard term. Some, so a lot of people kind of shy away that don't understand that or don't like it. But for the people who've owned government buildings, they like love it. High credit. It's very, very sticky tenants. So I think if you get into something and you really learn it, then you can find opportunities within there and build the relationships with, you know, brokers like us who do government lease. Or if you like medical, you know, study that, understand that. I think medical is going to have strong demand. You might not get as cheap a price on those, obviously. But I think I like medical office. I like user office. I like small suites. I like big vacant buildings where there's demand that's growing, and just building relationships with brokers in your market or in the expertise that you're looking at.
Is there an exercise that one should go through to really hone in on who are the, you know, I guess maybe the top three brokers in that respective market? I mean, like you get in some big cities, I mean, there's, you know, potentially dozens. Mm-hmm. Of brokerages that are specializing in office, but is there a good exercise that one can go through to maybe like narrow it down pretty quickly to the top three they should be having an interview with and chatting with to better understand the marketplace?
Yeah, I think it's just really getting out there and looking, and when you get into the larger assets, some of those are less publicly marketed. So maybe that's why you're asking. I mean, because on the smaller assets, they're more publicly marketed and you can kind of go out there and figure out who's buying and selling those and who's active. But on the really larger assets, I think you just got to figure it out and find out who's really active, and who to connect with. And when you contact a broker, let them know your capability. Let them know your experience level. Be straight with them. Do you have your equity? Do you got to raise your equity? You know, how do you fund the deals? You know, just be straight with them where you are in your life as far as that asset class goes, because, you know, brokers can be your best friend, right? So when to bring you a great deal. Another thing I'd recommend brokers, investors do with brokers. If you find a good one and they're in your space that you want to be in, let them know that you'll protect them on off market deals and that you'll underwrite their fee and you'll sign off that you will keep it extremely quiet. So maybe they bring you an off market opportunity. Now, you can waste a lot of time off market. The sellers haven't been managed properly. You don't have good information. So some investors don't like to look at off market. They've just wasted too much time. But I think it's an opportunity if you're breaking into a market to maybe get a look at an opportunity because you've made sure that broker knows I will take care of you.
We buy a lot off market, and I would say that it's probably one of those areas that creates a lot of strain and stress and emotional roller coasters in my life, just due to the the expectation has been set appropriate. The sellers are not prepared sometimes to sell. They're still maybe emotionally undecided of whether or not they're selling, and so a good broker is worth his weight in gold. He or she really is. So, one other question I wanted to ask earlier on, and I forgot, was about property tax assessments. Obviously, a lot of these buildings have lost value, over these years. And so, has there been a lot of active appeals from building owners appealing the assessed value? And then, if so, you know, gosh, I can imagine the type of financial impact that's had on municipalities.
Yeah, they have, and it has, and it continues to happen. And the larger the clients, the larger the properties, the more we find they just do it almost all the time. It's just a part of their business practice to argue these assessments. So yeah, it's continuing to happen. And I think when you're an investor, you want to look at that and see, is there an opportunity to potentially reduce your cost with fighting your assessment, or is the opportunity that your taxes may go up because the assessment's lower than what you're paying, and you want to underwrite that. I'm sure you've known that a long time, but we do see some investors who go, oh, the taxes are X. Yeah, but the assessment's 50% of what you're paying.
Don't open up the can of worms if you shouldn't, right?
You know, another thing that we do when we take a property out to market, talking about off market versus on market, is we add credibility to the offering because, you know, we're not going to be wasting our time. We've managed the seller's expectations. Are you going to steal it? No, you're not going to steal it. But it's going to be marketed well. You're going to get great information. You're going to be treated right. It's a seller that wants to sell. They've listed the property. So it also can just add a lot of credibility when you're taking something out to market with someone who knows how to do it and has a good reputation with the buyers in the space.
No, all valid points there. Well, Michael, this has been a lot of fun, incredibly valuable. Really appreciate you coming on the show and just sharing all your insights. I'd say before we wrap things up here for the day, I wanted to give you the opportunity to share any final thoughts for our audience that you might have. No right or wrong here, investing advice, words of wisdom, whatever comes to mind.
All right. I'm going to give you some really sage advice that is you probably, you're going to hang your hat on this forever. You ready?
Let's do it.
Buy low, sell high.
I love it. Simple, but incredibly impactful and profound. So good stuff, Michael. You know, for everyone listening here today, thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast. And if you've enjoyed the show today, please do take a moment to subscribe and leave a rating and review. It really helps us attract awesome guests just like Michael here to the show and keeps the show growing. So until next week's show, wishing you guys strong deals and even stronger cash flow. Take care now.